Okay, again, it's good to see everyone this morning and looking forward to the study. This study in the book of Philippians, or the epistle letter to Philippians, is going to be very different than what we've been doing recently. The book of Ephesians, as you'll remember, was at least in the very first three chapters of that epistle, very dense theologically. And that's really not the case with regard to Paul's letter to Philippians. It had a different purpose, a different reason for writing. And it's kind of an interesting thing when you go to those modernist critics and they try to determine who wrote any particular book, and often they'll diverge from the traditional opinions in that regard, even if the author identifies himself. Often they'll make objection. One of the reasons why is they'll talk about a particular epistle that the writer wrote, and then they'll compare another epistle where there is that claim that he wrote that, and they'll see stylistic differences. I've always thought that to be rather peculiar, because I know as a pretty active writer myself, all the materials that I write, that my style changes depending upon what I'm trying to accomplish, very much so. And the style of the book in Paul's letter to Philippians, although he uses some of the same terminology, there are some similarities, and Paul obviously wrote the epistle. It's very different because it's very positive. One that expresses a great deal of devotion and emotion toward these individuals. He likes the Philippians. He loved the Corinthians and the Galatians, but he didn't like them too much just because of the way they were acting. In other words, their carnal natures and their divisions and their sinful practices and the error that was present in those churches and such. He had to deal with those things. And so the tone was a little bit more, I wouldn't say dark, but more for the purpose of offering admonition. And there's very little admonition to be found in the book of Philippians. And in fact, when we look at these final letters, you remember this is a study of all of Paul's writings, and where you have either the difficult and challenging doctrinal questions and issues in Romans and Ephesians and Colossians and even Galatians to a certain extent, and the admonitions and rebukes that he gave to the Galatians and the Corinthians. The last four letters that we're going to be studying, which will be Philippians, 1 Timothy, Titus, and 2 Timothy, they have a different tone, partly because of his affection and closeness to the individuals to whom he writes, and also because of the purpose of the book. He had two proteges, Timothy and Titus, and he is writing to them, explaining to them how they should conduct themselves as evangelists, what the needs of the churches that they'll be worshiping and working with will be, and dealing with those kinds of issues. That will be an interesting study. But this letter that Paul writes to the Philippians is one where he expresses his appreciation and love for the brethren because of what they had done for him. And it's a very interesting and it's a very uplifting book. I think you're going to enjoy the study that we will engage in the next few months in this particular epistle. Now, with regard to the handout that we handed out 2 weeks ago, I just want to acknowledge something I probably have before, but I think about this each time we do this. I'm continuing the same form because I wanted to have consistency with regard to the form in all of these letters. And so they all have the same approach that are taken to them. We'll talk about the metadata today. There is a concise outline that is given on page 1, an expression of Paul's purpose in writing, chapter synopses, and then suggested memory work. And this material is really not designed to be gone over in class. It's for your benefit, especially the outline and the chapter synopses. So I would encourage you to take the time to familiarize yourself with the outline. One of the benefits of having an outline and familiarizing yourself with it is that it gives an organic structure to any particular book. And most of them have an organic structure. You have an intent and purpose. You have thoughts and a delineation of thoughts as the apostle goes from one topic to another topic in his discussion. And by having a familiarity with the outline, although you may not know, say you're studying with someone, and you're familiar enough with the book of Philippians to know that there's a particular passage that is found in that book that you want to share, but you don't know where it is. You have a familiarity with the structure of the book. It could even be just the major points that are there. For example, if you want to think about the Apostle Paul's statement, "For to me to live is Christ, but to die is gain." Okay, where is that found? Well, you know that's found in the first chapter of the book, as Paul talks about the progress of the gospel in the circumstances he finds himself in, which of course is found there with the second point. And so you can kind of familiarize yourself with the material in this regard without having to necessarily read the text to have or have a memorized familiarity with the text by just having that outline in front of you or in your mind. The chapter synopses that we're not going to look at today, these are basically my summaries of each chapter. So if you want again to familiarize yourself with what the book of Philippians is about, in your studies, you may want to read that from time to time. It's just a few short paragraphs. And then, of course, on the second page, which is the back of the first page, it's two pages front and back. On the second page, there is suggested memory work. And what I've done with that, as with all of them, is look at passages that might have a practical application, passages with which you may be familiar, passages which have something of import in them. And again, it's not necessarily that you will memorize each of these. If you want to do it, have at it. It's certainly not an assignment that I'm going to give. I like that we do that with young people. With us, as we get older, it's actually a little bit more difficult, I think, for us to memorize than what it used to be. But some of these you will be familiar with. You may be surprised with how many of these you are familiar with. And again, at least a familiarity with them is something that is helpful and important. But looking at the difficult passages, the doctrinal considerations, the practical considerations, and then the questions to consider that are on the back of the last page, that makes up the bulk of our study. And as we've talked about with all of these particular lessons, while what I've done here, in, for example, with regard to the starting off with the difficult passages, I've gone through, and from chapter 1 down to chapter 4, the four chapters of Philippians, I've looked at those things. And then I start over again with the first chapter with the doctrinal considerations, and again with the practical considerations, then with questions. So we don't want to study it that way. and this is my acknowledgement, is that probably, even though I've maintained this structure, it's not the best way to have structured it. I just want to be consistent and do the same all the way through, have these study guides. That's not how we're actually going to do it. We're not going to look at the difficult questions first and then go back and look at the doctrines, then go back and look. We're going to do it in a more linear fashion. So what I have done is basically compiled all of those four things in a more linear fashion, just like I did with the gospel or the letter to the Ephesians. And so what we'll do is we look at the handouts, we'll have it in a more linear, starting at the first chapter, going down to the last, but covering all of the material that's found in those four categories. And so again, if that's somewhat confusing, then what you can do is either draw some lines as to which is which and at what point, or just follow along and get into the text. I've compiled that in a Microsoft handout that I could actually give to you in a more linear fashion if you'd like me to do that. If you have an interest in that, just let me know. But anyway, the material is what's contained in this particular book. So what we wanted to do today is to begin our study by looking at the metadata. If I get the thing to move. Let me get a little bit farther forward and see if for some reason there's just a... this irritates me. I don't want to mess up because I at least want to give you... Oh, that's what's happening. There was an update on the way. Okay, so here is the map that we have, and we actually have the same map up with our study to Paul's letter to the Ephesians with some modifications. So what we have there is the Mediterranean Sea in Philippi, the location of Philippi just off the northern coast of the Mediterranean. Actually, I wish I could use my pointer, but every time I put my laser up on the screen, it goes away because of the brightness of the screen. just so that you'll see how I think about things, that looks like a shoe to me. Mediterranean shoe, see, looks like one of those clogs with the curved up toe and then the heel on the bottom left. And so the tongue of the shoe is where Philippi is located. That's how I kind of remember. But that tongue there is actually called the Aegean Sea. So it's a smaller sea that is adjacent to the Mediterranean. And so that's where Philippi is located in the eastern part of Macedonia. And Italy looks like a boot, go-go boot to me. So that's the land over to the left. And so that's kind of the way I look at it when I look at those things. I wanted to just take some time looking at some of the facts about the city of Philippi as a part of our metadata, and then we'll look at the metadata itself. So starting off with Philippi. It was located again in eastern Macedonia, the region of Macedonia there marked on the map, about 10 miles inland from the Aegean Sea. It was situated, the geography of the land, basically a broad plain that is surrounded by mountains, but there was a hill in the midst of that plain, which gave the city some fortification as the city rested on top of that hill. So you've got mountains around, a broad fat plain, and an elevated location there where the city of Philippi was. Philippi was a very important city, as we'll look at in just a few moments' time. But there is no city there today. So it no longer exists as a city, and there is actually no city near the site where it was located. They've done some archaeological excavations. They have an understanding of exactly where the city is, but there is not a modern city that exists on top of it. So what you had was a plain area that was, and the city sat on that hill, and on both the eastern and western sides of the city, you had two rivers, and then about a mile away, a smaller river to the west. And the reason why that has any significance to me at all, the rivers of the Nestus and the Strymon River, they're at the borders of the city. But a mile west, there was another river that is referred to as the Gangites, Gangites River. And I think that's probably the river where Paul and his companions went and met Lydia. You remember in Acts chapter 16 and verses 13 and 14, we're told that on the Sabbath day, Luke said, we went out of the city to the riverside where, out of the city to the riverside where prayer was customarily made, and we sat down and spoke to the women who met there. And then a certain woman named Lydia, heard us. And of course, she was converted with her household, as is located in that text. So that river was probably about a mile outside of the city. That's probably the one that's referred to, the Gangites River. So keeping that in mind, just giving you a kind of an overview of what it was like, there are some other details I want to share with you. But the city was actually named after the father of Alexander the Great, Philip II of Macedon. And so that was, you'll remember that there was there were the four great kingdoms. You had the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Alexandrian kingdom, which had reference to Alexander the Great, and then the Roman kingdom. Now, keeping that in mind, with the decline of the Medo-Persian empire, you had the beginnings of another great empire. Philip of Macedon was a king that went about warring and gaining land. And then, of course, his son Alexander came after him and established that great world empire. It didn't last a long time, but it was a very significant empire during the time of his existence. And so there was a small settlement that was nearby to where the city of Philippi was found called Crenides. And it had been there for several hundred years. And basically, after he, for strategic purposes, the king, the Macedonian king Philip, after he conquered that land, he rebuilt the city, and he named it after himself. So when we hear the city Philippi, it's named after Philip II of Macedon, and He's the one that named it. So I guess to the winner goes the spoils. He's the one that named it for himself. And it was, of course, after the division of the Alexandrian kingdom at the death of Alexander the Great. He died at a very young age, I think 30 years old, somewhere about that time. He had four generals. And those four generals basically divided the kingdom up amongst themselves. And the last one maintained his land as the onslaught of the Romans began was Perseus. And Perseus was finally routed. And when that happened, the city of Philippi came under Roman control. And so that city, which is kind of an interesting thing, what makes it somewhat significant is found in Acts chapter 16 and verse 11. Okay, this narrative will be looking at Acts 16, some passages there, so you may want to turn over to that chapter in your New Testament as we talk this morning. What we're talking about is the second missionary journey of Paul as he went to Philippi. It's the first time that he was in the city of Philippi. And when he was in that city, that's when he, of course, met with Lydia outside the city at the river. But we're told in verses 11 and 12 that he came into the city sailing from Troas, went, ran a straight course to Samothrace, the next day came to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi. And it's described as the foremost city of that part of Macedonia, a colony. And so there is if there's any significance to the city of Philippi, it's the fact that it was a Roman colony. That's the significant thing. So when the Romans took over, they divided the district of Macedonia into four parts. The part that Philippi was in the east, there was actually another city that was the capital of that particular part or province of Macedonia, and that was Amphipolis. And it's actually an interesting thing when they look at the city itself and talk about it. Why was Philippi referred to as the foremost city of that part of Macedonia when Amphipolis had been the capital? Wasn't at that time, not when Paul wrote. Thessalonica was the capital as they had combined the four back into one. But Amphipolis was at one point the capital. But I think the significance of that is the foremost city, the most important city, was Philippi, because Philippi was the Roman colony. And there was some significance to Roman colonies. The Roman colonies were primarily established for strategic purposes, military purposes. You know that as with all empires. I mean, you know, you've got Italy. I don't know what's going on here. I'm going to have to probably let it reboot, so we'll just leave that alone. You saw that, man. So with regard to the city of Philippi, established as Roman colony, again, for strategic purposes, a big Roman empire, there had to be self-governance. And in fact, you'll remember in Judea that there was, for example, during the time of Jesus' life, a governor of that area, that region, which was Pilate, but there was also a king, and the Jews were allowed, to a very great extent, to run their own lives. I mean, they had their own set of laws. There were certain things that were required of every city, every aspect of the Roman Empire, Roman laws that had to be followed. And interestingly, one of those laws was that the Jews could not practice capital punishment, which is why it was necessary for the Jewish leaders, after they pronounced judgment of death upon Jesus, they couldn't put him to death themselves. They had to go to Pilate and ask for permission from Pilate, who was the governor of Judea, to have Jesus put to death. And of course, the Roman method of execution was the cross, which is why Jesus was on the cross. If it would have been the Jews, it would have been a stoning. But in this particular city, in the city of Jerusalem, there were those laws that had to be followed, especially when you had the interaction between the Jewish leaders and the Roman leaders. So there were local laws and such that were allowed as long as the Romans ultimately were in charge. That wasn't the case in colonies. So the colonies were put at strategic places throughout the empire, and there was a strong Roman presence in the colonies. When you talk about a Roman colony, you have a city that was primarily made up of Romans. Now here in Philippi, there were some Greeks, some Macedonians that were there as a part of that heritage. And of course, there were Jews. But the primary citizenship of the city of Philippi was Roman. And a Roman colony, as it was built to look like Rome. Maybe a miniature version, but it had the same kind of structure. It had the same layout, the same kind of public buildings as the Roman colony. And an interesting thing about this is that, because it's impactful there in Acts chapter 16, is that individuals who were citizens of the city, whether they were Romans or not, had the same privileges of Roman citizens because they were living in a Roman colony. So they were treated like Roman citizens. Now you may remember that the Apostle Paul, on a number of occasions, and Acts 16 is one of them, made an appeal to the fact that he was born a Roman citizen. You remember when the centurion and he had their discussion as he was set upon by the Jews in the book of Acts prior to his trip to Rome and his Roman imprisonment. With this threat of being beaten, he asked the centurion, "Are you a citizen?" He said, I purchased that. And Paul said, "I was born a Roman citizen." And one of the things about Roman citizens is that they could not be scourged. There were only a few circumstances that they could be beaten as a matter of course in the arrest. In Acts 16, Paul and Silas were. You'll remember there was a great conflagration that happened, a great argument that arose when Paul had cast out a woman who had a spirit of divination. And as a result of that, the masters kind of caused an uproar, and accusations were made against Paul and Silas, and they were beaten and thrown into prison. They were Roman citizens. Now we know for a fact that Paul was, and it seems to be, in the wording that Paul used, that Silas was as well. And the magistrates or the leaders of that city became very, very worried because the Apostle Paul made it clear that he was a Roman citizen. They were worried about their treatment of him. And so they treated him well after he got out of prison, put it that way, because they were afraid that they would get in trouble for it. So what I thought to be interesting is that if you lived in Philippi, even though you may be a Jew and not a Roman citizen, you had the rights of the Roman citizen. And if you traveled outside of the city of Philippi to other parts of the Roman Empire and identified yourself as a citizen of Philippi, you retained those rights even outside of the city as a Roman citizen. So there were some real benefits to be members of a Roman colony. And again, a very strategic purpose in having such colonies to maintain the power of Rome, which of course existed for a long, long period of time. That's basically what I wanted to let you know about the city itself. Anybody have any questions about the city of Philippi before we get into the metadata that we made note of? And I apologize for the fact that happened. I'm going to have to turn the automatic updates off, I'm afraid. Okay, so let's just think about the metadata for a few moments, which is located at the top left of the first page, the very first material that's there. And first of all, I just kind of wanted to note that, as we have already mentioned, there were four books that the Apostle Paul wrote while he was imprisoned in Rome. We've already studied three of those: Philemon, which was a personal letter that he wrote to Philemon about Onesimus, that runaway slave. And then there was a letter that he wrote to the church in Colossae, and one that he wrote to the church in Ephesus, which we have studied in the last two sections of our study on Paul's letters. It is believed that, and I think it's primarily because of the time that he had spent and what had happened in that period of time he was in prison that he refers to in Philippians chapter 1. It's believed that that was the final letter. The letter to the Philippians was the final letter that was written, and it was near the end of his imprisonment there in Rome. The book has four chapters, 104 verses, and the reason I bring that up is because it's a short book, and I looked it up. I'm a relatively fast reader, so I wanted to know what the average time of reading the book Philippians is, or the letter to the Philippians. I think we ought to say letters, rather than books, because you think books, you think of, oh, that's a thick thing. It takes about 15 minutes to read Paul's letter to the Philippians for an average reader. Now, you may read a bit slower than average, you may be reading a bit quicker than average, but about 15 minutes. So, I was just thinking that maybe it would be a good resolution to read Philippians once a week until we finish this study. I think if you were to do that, then at the very least you would have a very real familiarity with the letter that Paul wrote. You wouldn't have to do much in the way of memorizing because you'll have read it. We'll probably spend, who knows, 25 weeks or more on this particular letter. Spend a lot of time reading that, read it 25, 30 times. There would be a real familiarity with it. It's only going to take 15 minutes a week. Not 15 minutes a day, but 15 minutes a week to do that. So, just a thought, something perhaps you could consider resolving to do in your personal study, and it would certainly help you in your preparation for the material that we're going to be discussing. Okay, so what I want to do is spend just a little bit of time talking about the Apostle Paul's close relationship, his affection for the church in Philippi, and how that came about. And so that's where we make note of Acts the 16th chapter. We're not going to take the time this morning to read all of that material. But beginning in verse 11, as we just read a few moments ago, we are told that the Apostle Paul and his companions went to Philippi, which is the foremost city of that part of Macedonia. And for the remainder of that chapter, going down through verse 40 of the text, we find what happened to him during that first trip. Now, that first trip is the one that we know something about. There are references to him returning to Philippi on another occasion. There's a reference to that in Acts the 20th chapter and verse 6. It's possible that he actually was there three times, because he went through Macedonia a second time and then returned back through Macedonia as he came back from Corinth. So we don't know that he was in Philippi both times, but on the return back from Corinth, that's what Acts chapter 20 and verse 6 refers to. But what we know about Paul's interaction in the city is found in Acts chapter 16. So, first of all, this second missionary journey and this trip to Philippi happened about AD 52. The book that he wrote, or the letter that he wrote to the Philippians while he was in Roman prison, about 10 years later. So he had about 10 years of interaction and relationship with the Philippians as a church, from the time in which he first met Lydia until the time that he wrote this book. And there had been, as we'll look at the text in our study, there had been a number of occasions where the Philippians had supported him in his ministry as he was in other places. There were times when the church in Philippi was the only church that was sending aid to him when he had need. But they were very faithful to him, which is one of the reasons why they were so special to him. But we find the first conversion, or the first conversions, in Acts chapter 16 and verses 11 through 15. Gone outside of the city. This was a place of prayer. Women were gathered together, worshiping, praying to God. And as they came across that group of women, they met Lydia. And Lydia heard them. And as a result of that, she and her household responded to the gospel of Christ. And in verses 11 through 15, we have recorded that conversion. Actually, we have two conversions that are found, and both of them are significant. Whenever we look through the book of Acts, we find a number of times where individuals were actually converted. There are statements about conversion a lot. We find some examples of conversion in Acts chapter 2. We've got the conversion of the 3,000 Jews on the day of Pentecost. In Acts, the 8th chapter, the conversion of the Ethiopian eunuch. In Acts chapter 9, the conversion of Paul. In Acts chapter 10, Cornelius. Acts chapter 16, we've got both Lydia as well as the Philippian jailer. And the interesting thing about that is that if you go through all of the examples of conversion in the New Testament, you'll find that they all did the same thing. They responded in faith by being baptized to have their sins washed away. So a penitent faith leading to baptism is how these individuals became Christians. And that similarity in all of the narratives is extremely important to us, as we know that there was a pattern established as to what one must do to be saved. You don't find an example of any of them saved at the point of faith. All of them were baptized. You don't find any of them that were saved by stating a sinner's prayer or some of the other theories that you see in the religious world today. Each and every one of them heard the gospel. They believed the gospel. They repented or turned away from the past life. And they were baptized to have their sins washed away. There is also, of course, the allusion in, the statement in Acts chapter 8 concerning the Ethiopian eunuch of the necessity of confessing the name of Christ before men, which the eunuch said, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." But those are the things we must do to be saved. And by going to that, you have a consistent pattern. So we talk about and we study the conversion of Lydia, the conversion of the jailer. And while there are those similarities, there are also very important lessons that can be taught by each. One of the favorites of mine is that the jailer, though it was very, very late at night, the same hour of the night, he was baptized, indicating how important it was to be baptized instantly or right away, because an individual's sins are not washed away until the point in time when one is baptized in water. So we're not going to take the time to talk about those things. Just note that the Apostle Paul went to the city and had interactions, some positive, some negative, as recorded in Acts chapter 16. And as a result of the fact, the church was started in that place. Lydia and her household were the first conversions. They continued in the city. And we find, beginning in verse 16, going down through verse 24 of the text, one of the bad things. And that is, as we alluded to earlier, Paul and Silas had a conflict with the masters of a slave girl. The slave girl had the spirit of divination. She could divine things. This was a demon possession. But she had that ability, which was making the master's money. But the Apostle Paul healed her. He cast out that spirit of divination, so she no longer had that ability. Now she was healed of that possession, which would have been a horrible thing for her, but it angered the masters because they lost their revenue that they were making from her. It's using the vernacular of our day, they were acting as pimps. It was simply that what they were doing is controlling and benefiting from this woman with regard to her particular talent, which was that spirit of divination. And so as a result of that, they caused an uproar. The magistrates became involved. Now the magistrates were Roman. Again, this is a Roman colony. The phrase magistrate has reference to a Roman leader. So the leaders of the city, the Roman leaders of the city, were referred to as magistrates. And when they heard this great kerfuffle, and Paul identified by these slave masters as a Jew, well, then Paul and Silas were beaten and they were thrown into prison. And so in Acts chapter 16 in verses 25 through 34, we find that second example of conversion, which happened as the Apostle Paul and Silas were actually imprisoned in Philippi. So this time the jailer, he was the one that was actually in charge of keeping them bound. We'll notice, again, looking in Acts chapter 16, beginning there in verse 25 of the text. Well, let's go back in verse 23. When they had laid many stripes on them, so they beat them, we are told they threw them into prison and commanded the jailer to keep them securely. This was the man who had actually been given the charge to keep them securely, and he took it seriously. We're told in verse 24 of the text, having received the charge, he put them in the inner prison, and he fastened their feet in stocks. So there's no way in the world they're going to get away, because they weren't on the outward section. They didn't have access to an outward wall. They were within, which was the most secure place, and they were actually in stocks. And that's when, of course, Paul and Silas prayed. They sang. There was an earthquake. The doors were opened to the prison, providential or miraculous intervention of God. The stocks fell off their feet and scared the jailer. We're told in verse 27, the keeper of the prison, awaking from sleep and seeing the prison's doors open, supposing the prisoners had fled, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself. But Paul called with a loud voice, saying, "Do yourself no harm, we are all here." Verse 30, he brought them out, said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And they said, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved, you and your household." And they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. And he took them the same hour of the night, washed their stripes, and immediately he and all his family were baptized. Now, I want you to note something. The jailer, no doubt, on this occasion, was an individual who was a Roman. He was in the employ of the Romans. It was a Roman colony. He was an individual who was a Roman. Of course, Acts chapter 10 with Cornelius, we find the first example of Gentiles being converted. But some time had passed. He was in Philippi. Here was a man who was a Roman, and they told him, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved." Now, in that statement, some people say, that's all you have to do is believe. I want you to understand that it's very similar to what we see with regard to the Ethiopian eunuch. He said, "What must I do to be saved?" And there are some who say he wasn't even talking about his soul being saved. He was concerned about his physical life because they had been released. And he was told to keep them. So he was afraid it was going to cost him his life because he wasn't doing a good job as a jailer. Regardless of that, whether or not that's the case, Paul told him what he needed to be saved eternally. And he appreciated it because we're told he did what we required of him. They said, "Believe on Jesus." How would the jailer know, or would the jailer know who Jesus was? We're not in Jerusalem. We are in a far-flung place. The first time the Apostle Paul had been there as he went on a missionary journey to spread the gospel of Christ, I can imagine the first question that the jailer had is, "Who's Jesus?" So when he told him to believe, the jailer didn't respond by saying, "I believe, so I'm saved." After he told him to believe, he taught him about Jesus. And that's stated something very clearly in the text in verse 32. "Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and all who were in the house." Now the reason why I think that's significant is because it parallels what happened with regard to the Ethiopian eunuch. Because the Ethiopian eunuch was going along and he was in Isaiah 53. He said, "Who is the prophet talking about himself or another?" And at that point, Philip preached unto him Jesus. That's what Paul was doing on this occasion. You have to believe in Jesus. So he preaches Jesus to him. What's a part of the preaching of Jesus? Now that becomes obvious both in Acts chapter 8 and Acts chapter 16. In Acts chapter 8, with the eunuch, as he preached Jesus to him, they came to some water. And the eunuch said, "See, here is water. What keeps me from being baptized? What hinders me from being baptized? If you believe, you may." He said, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." They went down into the water. Philip baptized him. They came up out of the water. The Spirit caught Philip away. The eunuch went on his way rejoicing. That's what happened in Acts chapter 8. So a part of the preaching of Jesus is preaching what Jesus requires of men. What is constituted in that command that you believe to be saved. And the same thing happened here. And we see the exact same result. No, it's not as explicitly stated as it was in Acts chapter 8. The instruction were given that you have to believe in Jesus. They taught him, and we are told that after they taught him, spoke the word of the Lord to him and all who were in the house, he took them in the same hour of the night and washed their stripes. That's an indication perhaps of penitence on his part, that he had accepted what they had to say. And immediately, he and his family were baptized. Part of preaching Christ, part of what you must believe about Christ in the gospel, there is that inclusion of the command to be baptized in water for the remission of your sins. And so this is, again, a very real parallel to what we find in Acts chapter 8. So I want to spend just a few moments talking a little bit about that. One of the interesting things, if you get into verse 35 of the text and going down to the end of the chapter, well, you notice what happened. Now, we already said that they had been accused by the masters. Let's go back to that so you can read up. Notice in verse 20, "They brought them to the magistrates and said, 'These men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city. They teach customs which are not lawful for us, being Romans, to receive or observe.'" So the Jews are trying to get us to do something that we as Romans ought not to do. These Jews. And so we're told in verse 23 that they, the magistrates, had laid many stripes on them and threw them into prison and commanded the jailer. Now, look at verse 25, or verse 35. "When it was day, the magistrate sent the officer saying, 'Let them in, go.'" I don't know why there was that change of heart. I don't know that there's any indication that it was because of anything that had happened in the prison. Not really any indication that the jailer had indicated or told anybody what had happened in the prison. We're told the next day that they had either a change of heart or they had determined, well, they've been in prison long enough. Just, you know, throw them in the clink overnight and then we'll let them go in the morning. But what Paul said there, the keeper of the prison, reported the words to Paul. He says, the magistrates, verse 36, have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace. And Paul said to them, they have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans. They've been called Jews, but now Paul's saying, we're Romans. And so that's an indication perhaps that Silas had Roman citizenship as well. Paul certainly did. They have thrown us into prison now. Do they put us out secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and get us out. And so we're told the officers told the words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Romans. And the reason why is because as Roman citizens, they could not be beaten as part of their imprisonment. An unconvicted Roman citizen. It's just kind of like the way we are today. You can be arrested, but there has to be that trial, and there has to be that determination of guilt before the punishment is meted out. That's the way it was in Rome for Roman citizens. Not for others, but for Roman citizens. And so that scared them. And we're told in verse 39 that they came and pleaded with them, brought them out, and asked them to depart from the city. And they went out of the prison, they entered the house of Lydia, and when they had seen the brethren, that's a neat phrase, because in that short period of time that they were there, I don't know who else was converted. You had Lydia and her household that were converted, but then you have the fact that as it begins in verse 16, as it happened, as we went to prayer, a certain slave girl possessed with the spirit of divination met us, who brought her masters much profit by fortune telling, that she followed Paul and us, and cried out, these men are servants of the Most High God who proclaimed to us the way of salvation. This she did for many days. So I don't know exactly how long that Paul was in Philippi, but Paul was preaching the gospel when he was there. And he had this testimony from this woman of the spirit of divination that he was preaching the way of salvation. I don't know if people were convinced because the lady with divination was saying that. She was right. Paul, though, was annoyed at her, and so he cast out that, or annoyed at the demon. He cast the demon out as a result of this. But in these many days that the Apostle Paul had been preaching, he had been converting people. I don't know how many, but there were brethren. It was not just Lydia and her household and the jailer and his household. We have Lydia and her household and the jailer and his household bookending the time that he spent in Philippi as he was proclaiming the gospel of Christ and converting individuals as a result of that. And so the brethren met at the house of Lydia. He met with them before they departed from the city. So the establishment of the church in Philippi was by the work of Paul himself. And so he had a very real familiarity with them. No doubt he was very affectionate toward them, and they to him. That's something that's evident as you get into the study of Philippi, the book to the Philippians, or the letter to the Philippians itself. And this relationship continued for the 10 years between that first trip and the writing of the book in AD 62, or the writing of the letter in AD 62. Okay, so the other thing that we'll note, and we'll go over this very quickly, is, again, he visited Macedonia a second time. As you go through the chronology, it was about 5 years later. It's a trip that is alluded to in 1 Corinthians 16 and also in 2 Corinthians 1. About AD 57, he left Ephesus, traveled by land to Corinth, passed through Macedonia on that occasion, that trip. In other words, as he determined to go to Corinth, and you'll remember in Acts chapter 16, he gave them the instructions to lay by and store, when I come to you, I'll take that collection and send it along. So that was the intent. And then after leaving Corinth, in Acts chapter 20, it's recorded that there were individuals who were seeking to kill him, Jews that were plotting to kill him. So instead of taking the direction that he intended to go to avoid that plot and to thwart that plot, instead he changed his plans and went, instead of by sea, he went by land across Macedonia again. And we're told he spent a small period of time there in Philippi on the way to Troas. Of course, in Acts chapter 20, we remember the time that he spent in Troas where he preached the gospel and the young man fell out of the window and he continued his speech until midnight, which is a great thing for all preachers to hear. To indicate that we're not the only ones that are long-winded, that Paul was as well. But that was in Acts chapter 20 and verse 6. Okay, so that's the idea that we get from the metadata. And although we're just about out of time, I just do want to note the purpose of writing. We've already made an allusion to it. That's fine. I found the middle of the second column on page 1. basically two primary purposes. One was to thank them, and that's why you'll see the tone in the letter being what it was. He wanted to thank them for the materials that they sent to him, but also to express and to let them know about his circumstances, his situation. He writes about himself and the situation he found himself in prison in that first chapter. There are two individuals that the Philippians were worried about. They were concerned about Paul because he was in prison, obviously so, and he had no surety that he would ever leave prison. He could be put to death at Caesar's whim. But also Epaphroditus, because they had heard that Epaphroditus was sick. And so Paul wanted to write this letter and send it back with Epaphroditus to let him know that he's okay. And an interesting thing about that, just kind of keep in mind the difference in our abilities to communicate. So, you know, the way you communicated was by letter, by courier, didn't have a post office. And so it took longer. But somehow they had become aware of the fact, because of travelers that had come and gone, that Epaphroditus, as he sought to bring their gift to Paul, that he had gotten sick. Paul said he almost died, but he's okay now. So he expressed that that Epaphroditus and he as well were well. In chapter 2 and verse 25 is when he talked about Epaphroditus. In verse 26, he was longing for you all, was distressed because you had heard that he was sick, for indeed he was sick almost unto death. But God had mercy on him, and not to him only, but to me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. And so there was that reason. The second one is what we might refer to as the primary impetus of the book. We're going to be spending the time that we have in our next few weeks not talking about doctrine an awful lot. There are a few things that we could categorize as doctrine in the book, but you remember where I put the practical applications up on the board? We're going to have an awful lot of those. And the reason why is what the Apostle Paul was concerned with. A couple of things. Number one, internally in the church, that there was some division or some possibility of division that existed. There are two women that are mentioned in the text, Euodia and Syntyche, that he said, you need to be of the same mind. So there seemed to be an admonition to them because there was some strife that existed between them. And so he talks about the importance of humility and unity in Philippians chapter 2. That's internal. Secondly, there was a reference to the Romans, the pagans that were out and around them, that might persecute them and cause them to lose their faith as a result of outward persecution. There's a reference to that in chapter 1 and verse 28. It says, do not be terrified by your adversaries, which is to them a proof of perdition, but you of salvation, and that from God. And then there was another warning. We're not going to spend much time on this in this particular epistle, but in chapter 3 and verse 2, he said, beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, beware of the mutilation. Now, remember in Galatians, where he told the Galatian churches, I marvel you're turning away so soon from the gospel of Christ to another gospel? That was the Judaizing teachers that had led the church astray. The Apostle Paul was dealing with Judaizers all of the time. Apparently, they hadn't made it to Philippi. But he said, in effect, they're coming. Be aware of them. And he called them mutilation. And we'll talk about that when we get into that particular text. But he was concerned about the possibility that this Judaizing influence that was affecting other churches might affect them. And so he warned them about it. So there are some warnings. There are some calls for acting in a particular way. That's the practical aspect of it. And then there was that overreaching desire to let them know about how he was doing and how much he appreciated what they had done for him. And that's what makes up the book of Philippians. I'm glad that I was able to get through the metadata in the first week. I don't like doing this particular lesson all that much. We'll get into some discussion, the actual study of the text, in our study next week. All right? Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.